Friends, welcome to tonight's talk in the Mansfield series. I'm Helena Kennedy, I'm the principal here at Mansfield College, and it's a very great pleasure for me to introduce to you Wes Streeting, who is, as you all know, one of our members of Parliament. He's a Labour Party member for Ilford North, was elected in 2015 at a general election there, and we all cheered. Because I have a particular warm and affection for him because of all the great stuff he's done on widening participation in education. And it's one of the things close to my own heart. And he has been a great champion of that. And his own story, I think, speaks to it so brilliantly. Because here was this boy from Tower Hamlets, a working class family brought up there in pretty straitened circumstances, and got to Cambridge, went to Selwyn College, and then ended up being right up there at the top of the National Union of Students before working in a number of different capacities in, as I say, working on widening participation in education in a foundation that I'm involved with, but also working on minority rights of many different kinds, and he's been a champion of basically disadvantage and all the work that he's done. And he now, of course, is one of the stars in the Labour Party, and I could think of nobody better to invite to talk about the state of the nation in these turbulent and challenging times. So, Wes, are you going to be able to make us feel that there is hope? Or
you'll do your best. Okay, that's what we want. Thank you. Great. Well, you've just sent me an even greater challenge than the one you sent me when you asked me to come and talk about the future of politics, but I'll do my best to be cheery, optimistic and hopeful. As Helena said, we go way back, actually. Shortly after I completed my term as President of the National Union of Students, I decided to make NUS history by being the first NUS president to go and get a job in the private sector for a bit of time away from politics, and off I went to PricewaterhouseCoopers. And as luck or fate would have it, a council by-election was called in the ward that I had lived in for the best part of 10 years, and I was encouraged by the local Labour Party to be a candidate in that by-election. So I thought, well, you know, it's a good way to keep my toe in the water politically. I've been moaning about area issues in the local area, and my general attitude in life is you want something done, you've got to do it yourself. And I thought it'd fit quite neatly alongside my new private sector career at PwC. Unfortunately, or fortunately, as it turned out, after my successful election to Redbridge Council, it turned out that the council was an audit client of PwC, and apparently that is a big no-no. And so therefore, I was forced to choose between my job or my seat on the council. And as I'd just spent literally weeks knocking on thousands of doors to persuade people to vote for me in a by-election caused in very similar circumstances, a candidate standing down because of their job, I didn't feel that I could let people down. So off went my lucrative career in the private sector, and I landed a job as chief executive of the Helena Kennedy Foundation, which, to be honest, was far more me, because the foundation works to tackle educational inequality by supporting disadvantaged FE college leavers to access higher education. And the students that HKF supports are people like care leavers, disabled students, BAME students, refugees, young parents, people who've had to jump over the highest hurdles to succeed in education and in life. And so, especially as, I mean, Helena mentioned, coming from my background, a very different 1% to the one we normally talk about, the 1% of the kids who receive free school meals and made it to Cambridge, I have a better understanding than most about how important access to money networks and know-how really is, and that's what the foundation strives to do because of its belief in the transformational power of education. And I know that Mansfield believes in the transformational power of education and in widening participation too. So at a time when it feels like the world has turned completely upside down, it's good to be in the home of non-conformist thinking, because goodness knows we need some. And it's even more wonderful to be hosted by someone who's given so much to the fight against inequality and injustice throughout her career. So of course, when Helena asked me to come and talk to you this evening, I instantly said yes. It was only afterwards she said she wanted me to talk about the state of the nation and the future of politics.
Just a small subject.
I mean, where to even start? I've been a Member of Parliament for barely 18 months now. If you were surprised to see my name on the term card, I was even more surprised to see my name on the coat peg when I arrived in Parliament to find myself elected, because my constituency, Orford North, which is a constituency on the London-Essex border, was 83rd on Labour's 106-strong target list, and it had a Conservative majority of 5,404. So when the exit poll came out on election night, I really didn't fancy my chances. In fact, when I arrived at the count, I arrived with only a concession speech. I'd like to tell you things have got better since. As one of just 10 Labour MPs to win a seat from the Conservatives in 2015, I've had a front row seat in what must be one of the most turbulent times in modern British political history. Corbyn, Brexit, Cameron, May, Corbyn again, Trump. I think we are wrestling with profound economic and political change, and it feels like something is very wrong with our country at the moment. I was born in 1983, and I think I've realised over the last year or two that I've taken for granted the onward march of social progress that I've seen throughout most of my life. In part because of my own journey from, as you've said, Helena, from a council estate in East London to where I am today, and in part because my adolescence took place during an economic boom and the advent of new technology, I'd assumed that we'd all just become better off, and as the white wristbands told my generation, we would make poverty history. I've grown up in a multicultural community in a global city. I've seen great advances in areas like race relations, disability rights, and the role of women in our society. As the Labour government changed the law on LGBT equality, they also changed hearts and minds and changed my life as a result. As a teenager struggling to reconcile my Christian faith and sexuality, I finally began to feel comfortable in my own skin. Martin Luther King famously said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice," and I've always believed in those words. But the last couple of years have shaken that conviction, and I worry about the future of Britain. So this evening I want to try and make some sense of what's happening to our country and offer some suggestions about what needs to be done. This is an unprecedented time of peace and global prosperity, yet also great anxiety and social upheaval. The benefits of globalisation and economic growth are being unevenly distributed, and people are acutely aware of their own relative disadvantage. Across Europe and the United States of America, people are sending a clear message to their leaders that they feel left behind, that they feel unheard, that they feel dislocated in the world that is changing around them. Now, there's something a little ironic about the emergence of a global movement against globalisation, but it's not hard to understand what's driving it. Since the global financial crisis of 2008, the biggest gains have been made by the richest. Since the 60s and 70s, communities whose jobs have been reliant on their strengths in traditional manufacturing have been hollowed out through a combination of labour-saving technology and outsourcing elsewhere. And young people across advanced economies face the prospect of growing up to be poorer than their parents. At times of economic upheaval and with pressure on livelihoods, history tells us that people become fearful and resentful. In the UK, we saw that resentment writ large during the EU referendum campaign. Resentment towards a political establishment that had let them down over many years on whether it's broken promises on issues like tuition fees or foreign follies like the war in Iraq, and the MP's expenses scandal, which I think confirmed in people's minds their very worst fear and cynicism about politicians, that we are all just in it for ourselves. Resentment towards the square mile for its role in a financial crisis that left ordinary taxpayers picking up the bill for a mess that wasn't of their making. Resentment towards immigration because of a belief that foreign labour is taking jobs, undercutting pay and conditions, and placing pressure on overstretched public services. Vote Leave, Take Control, Make America Great Again, or Non Du Peuple, the clarion calls of the political movements capitalising on the anxiety of people in the UK, the USA and France. Just this week, Marine Le Pen declared that the divide is not between left and right anymore, but between patriots and globalists. She wouldn't be the first fascist in European history to turn an economic crisis into a political opportunity to inspire hatred, but in identifying globalisation as the enemy within her sights, she is striking a powerful chord. The tragedy is that the Le Pens and the Trumps of this world, who play on people's fears and society's worst prejudices for electoral gain, also champion the very policies that will make their voters' lives worse. People like me on the centre-left have a fight on our hands. Our job is to appeal to people's hopes and aspirations by providing real answers to the challenges facing our century. But for too long, we've been out of office and out of answers. Once again, the Labour Party is learning the hard way that winning elections matters and losing has consequences. Right now, we need a government that will deal with the inequality driving people's fears and insecurities. And this country has a lot going for it. We're the world's sixth largest economy. We have 12 of the world's top 100 universities. And my partner, who is a graduate of this great university, likes to remind me, is currently top in the Times Higher World Rankings. We're third in the Global Innovation Index nationally. Global companies and leading industries choose to base their headquarters here. But at the same time, our country faces big economic challenges too. Wages are stagnant and living standards are falling. Our consumer spending is driven by credit, and we're lagging behind on productivity. Demographic changes mean a lower tax base, rising social care costs, and even greater questions about how we pay for it. The number of pensioners will rise by a third to 17 million in 2041. And in the next 20 years, it's projected there'll be 1.4 million households headed by someone aged 85 or over. So whether you voted Leave or Remain in the referendum, I think we can all agree that the decision to leave the European Union presents significant challenges for our economy. We're leaving the most advanced political and economic alliance in the world. As members of the single market and the customs union, as part of the largest free trade area in the world, we currently have unfettered access to a market of 500 million consumers. Moreover, our membership of the EU facilitates global trade, with more free trade agreements than the USA, China, Canada, Japan, Russia, India, or Brazil. Every single sector of our economy will be affected in some way by the deal that our Prime Minister does or doesn't strike. In the best of times, we would want to make sure that our future relationship with the European Union safeguards jobs and trade so that we can build on our economic strengths so that all our citizens can continue to enjoy rising living standards and greater prosperity. But in these times, where our economic recovery is fragile, and where voters delivered a shock to the political establishment, in large part due to the economic pain that they're experiencing, it is absolutely essential. So my jaw dropped when I heard our former Chancellor, George Osborne, tell the House of Commons last week that the government has chosen, and I'm quoting now, the government has chosen to not make the economy the priority in this negotiation. Just think on that for a moment. Our government, presiding over a fragile economic recovery and a divided country, has chosen not to make the economy the priority. As the higher education sector knows probably better than most, that's because the government has chosen to prioritise concerns about immigration over our national economic interest. Now, I've lost count of the number of times I've heard calls for a real debate on immigration. They arrive like the seasons. Some in my party argue we must take a tougher line on immigration to match the public mood. But if we're going to have a real debate on immigration, that requires an argument. So here is mine. Immigration is good for our economy and it is good for our society. Indeed, it becomes more important with an ageing society and a shrinking working age population. Those who want less immigration must tell us how they intend to pay for public services and pensions and how they plan to grow our economy. And those of us who defend immigration must ensure that British workers receive the skills they need to find work and that we have sensible controls in place to manage migration. There are a number of things we could do. We could introduce better controls to make sure that migration delivers the global talent our economy actually needs. And for me, that includes getting rid of this ludicrous cap that's affecting international student recruitment and our ability to recruit lecturers to universities like this. Seriously look at the options around a regional work permit system to allow nations and regions who need more migration to recruit the talent they need. Provide a proper migration impact fund to make sure the public services and infrastructure can cope from additional people, recognising that the concerns that people often raise on the doorstep aren't about culture or race or faith, it's everyday practical concerns about public services and making sure we have a system that's managed in an appropriate way. What we should not do is relegate the economy to the second division of concerns. And as far as I'm concerned, any government that doesn't make the economy the priority doesn't deserve the trust of the British people. But particularly at this moment, the absolute priority has got to be the economy, and not just in general terms, but in addressing the economic inequality that is fueling people's fears and anxieties. We're at the start of a new industrial revolution that will be like globalisation on steroids. The World Bank estimates that 57% of jobs in OECD nations are susceptible to automation, rising to 69% in India and 77% in China. A revolutionary moment in the world's history is a time for revolutions, not for patching. So said William Beveridge in his landmark report in 1942. It was true then, and it remains true today. So just as the Attlee government built a welfare state from the rubble of the Second World War, so too the Labour Party today should embrace the challenge of reshaping post-Brexit Britain, reimagining social democracy to meet the big social and economic challenges of this century. Beveridge's five giants of want, squalor, ignorance, disease and idleness have a modern relevance today as we seek to eradicate poverty and reduce inequality, build the housing and infrastructure that our people and our economy need, equip people with education and lifelong skills for the 21st century, address the health and social care crisis, and consider the future of work in an age of automation. It's clear that too many people on the right of politics remain fixated with the idea that government has little role to play in growing our economy or strengthening our society. Just look at the ineptitude of Sajid Javid as business secretary, who banned the use of the words industrial strategy in the business department and planned some holiday time in Australia, while the fate of British jobs in the steel industry was being sealed in India. Perhaps that's why today the government's leaked documents about their economic priorities has put the steel industry as a third order issue. But I have to say, even in my own party, there are those who suffer with a strange affliction that sees a private sector providing 1810 jobs as a necessary evil, best summed up in that most lazy of soundbites, public good, private bad. As Attlee argued in his speech to the Labour Party conference in 1946, it is social democracy which can best set us free from the tyranny of economic power and preserve us too from the dangers of the absolute power of the state. So this evening I want to set out a few ideas about what a modern Beveridge report might say about today's challenges facing Britain. Beveridge himself might be surprised by the prevalence of UK poverty 70 years on from his original analysis of want in our society. 4 million children grow up today living in poverty, an average of 9 children in every classroom of 30. A combination of falling incomes, rising costs and welfare cuts has led the Institute for Fiscal Studies to predict a 50% rise in relative poverty by 2020. The last time we saw such a sharp rise in child poverty was when I was growing up in the 1980s. But as a constituency MP, I'm struck by how different the circumstances of my own bringing were compared to the children I represent growing up in similar circumstances today. I grew up in a single-parent household on a council estate in Stepney in Tower Hamlets, East London. We didn't have much. When my mum was able to find work, it was often poorly paid, temporary and casual, which made the support network of family living by and Wapping and Stepney and Stepney Green and Bow absolutely essential for childcare. And occasionally it was useful for raiding my nan's cupboards too when food was short. The benefit system put food in the fridge, helped with school uniform costs, fed me at school and kept a roof on my head at home. I used to think I was unlucky, not having the latest trailers or games consoles, not being able to invite friends around to play because we were too embarrassed that our home wasn't as nice as some of the kids from better off families, going without electricity because the meter had run out, and so had the money. But then I look at the kids growing up with parents in the same circumstances today. They're not in a council flat with security of tenure, they're in unaffordable and shabby private rented accommodation, or temporary bed and breakfast accommodation. Some of them are commuting to school in West London from my constituency in East London in the morning, because that's where they came from before they found themselves homeless and placed by the local authority in my borough, Beveridge. Their parents do a 2 to 3 hour round trip twice a day because their schooling is their only stability in life and they don't know where they might move next. They've been moved away from family and friends, the vital support network that might help mum or dad to get a job that fits around school hours. They're using food banks because they don't have enough money to eat. For me, the state was my security net and my springboard. It meant I didn't go hungry or homeless, and it gave me the education I needed to be where I am today. There is a tragic irony about the welfare debate in our country today. The welfare system lacks public confidence, but it also fails the people who need it. Not just the kids like me, but disabled people who can't work, and face the bureaucracy and indignity of regular inquisitions by amateur pen pushers making judgments against the weight of medical evidence. The pensioners for whom retirement feels more like a prison sentence than a reward for a life of hard work, because they don't get the care they need for good quality life in their final years. Those in work and in poverty, the worst of all worlds, working hard and having nothing to show for it. As my colleague Dan Jarvis argued recently, what is most shocking about the state of this failure is that it costs so much. The Joseph Rowntree puts the cost of poverty to the public purse at £78 billion. So I think we need to reimagine the welfare system from first principles. A welfare system that acts as a safety net, preventing destitution and supporting people into work. A welfare system that expects you to work, providing meaningful support to help people to reskill, retrain, and find employment. But also opportunities to give back to society through community action whilst job hunting, building friendships, networks, and skills in the process. A welfare system that works for those who can't, providing a level of support to disabled people that gives them freedom, dignity, and quality of life. A welfare system that recognises contribution, so that if you've paid in, you can access greater government support to help with things like mortgage interest payments if you become suddenly unemployed. A welfare system that makes work pay, so that the combination of in-work benefits, minimum wages, and taxation policy means that families will always be prevented from falling below the poverty line. Tackling poverty isn't just a social policy. It's a crime prevention policy, a health policy, and an economic policy. To tackle disease, the original Beveridge report laid the foundations for the Attlee government to create the National Health Service. Next year, it will be 70 years old. During that time, it survived under-resourcing and attacks on its universal principles. And although the word crisis has been used often to describe today's NHS in crisis, I think is something of an understatement. Hospitals are struggling to cope with rising A&E admissions and delays to operations. GP practices are overwhelmed with an ageing workforce, an insufficient pipeline of new GPs coming on board. Local authority cuts are compounding social care pressures, leading to avoidable hospital admissions, delayed discharges, and poor quality of life for disabled and older people. That's why I support the view of my colleagues in Parliament, Labour's Liz Kendall, the Lib Dems' Norman Baker, and the Conservatives' Dr. Dan Poulter, that we need an independent commission on the future of health and social care in our country, how we fund it properly, how we make it work. Labour created the NHS, and now we should seek to build a new cross-party consensus around social care. Education has a powerful role to play, not just in tackling ignorance, as Beveridge diagnosed it, but in tackling poverty and inequality. It also has an important role to play in unlocking the talent and potential of every citizen, which is increasingly not just a social good, but an economic necessity. In the UK, we must meet that challenge in the context of an ageing society. Helena, before we came in, we talked about your seminal report, Learning Works, which is 20 years old this year, which looked at widening participation into further education and lifelong learning. And though I remain immensely proud of the educational record of the last Labour government, your observation then, that if at first you don't succeed, you don't succeed, remains sadly all too true today. The UK lags significantly behind our competitors on basic skills like literacy and numeracy. Did you know there are 1 in 5 adults in this country who do not have the basic literacy skills that we would expect of an 11-year-old? With more of the population expected to work longer, we need to make sure they can reskill and retrain. And this is urgent. I meet people in my constituency advise surgeries today in their 50s and 60s, able to work, unable to find a job, but also unable to retire. A modern Beveridge report would build a further education system that's simple, easy to understand for learners and employers, and joined up. And there also needs to be a genuine and sustained commitment to widening participation in higher and degree level apprenticeships, just as the last Labour government led a sustained effort on widening participation in our universities. Because frankly, although the further education sector has much to be proud of in general terms in widening participation, frankly, the participation level in apprenticeships, particularly amongst BME communities and disabled people, ought to make sector leaders blush with embarrassment. We can't rest on our laurels on the future of the school system either. I'm hesitant to propose more piecemeal curriculum reform. I think our schools have had enough. Michael Gove was a big advocate of chaos theory in education, and unfortunately he did what he said on the tin. A modern Beveridge report might draw some of the following conclusions though. A world-class education system is about people, high-quality leadership, and well-trained educators who have the freedom to experiment and build professional expertise. The early years of a child's life remain one of the greatest predictors of success at the age of 16, which is why investment in early years and high-quality childcare for the poorest families must be a priority. Mathematics and science become more important in this century, not less, and our current performance is frankly not good enough. We need to rethink pedagogical approaches to these subjects, make computing a fourth core science to prepare our new generation of digital natives to be digital creators, and we need to make financial literacy a key part of the curriculum to tackle our country's lackadaisical approach to personal debt, savings and pensions. We need to pay more attention to nurturing character and resilience, creativity and critical thinking to turn out young people ready to be active and engaged citizens, but also agile workers. School budget cuts that threaten the performing arts are a risk to this goal. Interestingly, I saw the government make an announcement to this, about this today, that every child doing theatre studies will be able to access the theatre. And yet I was struck by the fact that my school, which obviously produced me, a Labour politician, more impressively produced John Boyega from Star Wars, both of us were beneficiaries of school drama, and yet school budget cuts means that my school no longer has either curricular or extracurricular drama provision. I think ministers might need a reality check on that front. Careers guidance in this country is also abysmal, yet so much of our individual success is reliant on good information, advice and guidance. We need to start from scratch and make this a national mission involving an army of employers to give young people better advice about planning their futures and making informed choices. I could also talk about higher education, but I figure if I talked you through each of my 30-odd amendments to the higher education bill, we may be here rather longer than you've given me time for. In the aftermath of the Second World War, Beveridge's squalor referred to the physical state of the country, and 75 years on, we must recommit to sharing the gains of national wealth across every part of the country. If we're to improve productivity and increase our citizens' life chances, then we must improve national infrastructure and housing. As IPPR's State of the North report in 2015 identified, the government's pipeline infrastructure projects in London amounted to some £22 billion, one-fifth of all UK spending, with just £14 billion allocated for the whole of the North of England. That's an area of 15 million people, twice the size of Scotland. In transport, £4,300 per commuter is spent in London each year, compared with just £710 per commuter in the North, down to £580 in the southwest and just £480 in the East Midlands. Improving regional productivity demands fairer UK investment in infrastructure to enable economic activity, reduce journey times, and include the most isolated and deprived communities. That means supporting the commitment to high-speed rail, built by British Steel, and including Liverpool and the North East as priorities, plus also improving existing intercity networks, especially from east to west. Intra-regional train and bus investment are priorities too. I don't mind telling you that if you tweet about the 20-minute wait for a central line tube from a party in Old Street at 2:30 in the morning, you'll receive some lively responses comparing their daily service in Blackburn or Rotherham, such as the gulf in transport infrastructure spending across the UK. So when people ask me why this bothers me as a London MP, especially one whose constituency benefits disproportionately from Crossrail, I have to say I'm bothered because the imbalance in our national economy that leaves too many people without also directly affects my constituents, whether they were born in Barkingside in Ilford North or have moved there from Barnsley or Bath. If British people feel they have to move to London or the South East to get on, that adds further pressure to demand on housing, public services and transport congestion. A regional renaissance must be led from within our towns and cities through a real commitment to devolution rather than trying to pull levers in Westminster and Whitehall. As a local councillor as well as a Member of Parliament, I know that decisions are made best when they are made closest to the communities they affect. We need a radical redistribution of power across all of England's regions with a presumption in favour of ceding power and budgets into the hands of local communities. And that must include the freedom for local authorities to borrow to invest. This week's housing white paper was yet another missed opportunity to genuinely solve Britain's housing crisis. More tinkering, more warm words about speeding up planning processes and getting tough on developers and helping first-time buyers, but this crisis is about simple supply and demand. Local authorities have a better track record of balancing their books than their paymasters in the Treasury, and I think it's about time we set them free to invest in a new generation of decent homes to buy and rent. So a modern beverage report would address the modern manifestations of want, ignorance, squalor, and disease. Well, that brings me to idleness and its modern manifestation, the huge question mark hanging over the future of work. Voltaire said that work saves a man from three great evils: boredom, vice, and need. But what happens in a future where the jobs of men and women are taken by robots? That sounds like something from science fiction, but increasingly it's science fact. The scale of technological development, not just of processes but artificial intelligence, is running at a pace that we are struggling to keep up with. As I've mentioned, some estimates suggest that up to 2/3 of jobs could be at risk of automation in the decades to come. Anxiety about the impact of automation on jobs isn't a new phenomenon. In 1589, William Lee was surprised to learn that Queen Elizabeth I refused to grant a patent for his stocking frame knitting machine because it would, in the words of the Queen, assuredly bring them to ruin by depriving them of employment, thus making them beggars. In the 19th century, the Luddite Rebellion saw skilled artisan workers across Nottinghamshire, Yorkshire and Lancashire destroy the machines that threatened their livelihoods as textile workers. And in 1930s, John Maynard Keynes warned of the phenomenon of technological unemployment. What makes this new industrial revolution, dubbed the fourth industrial revolution, so different from the past is not simply the scale and pace of technological advancement, but also the scope. The development of technology and learning algorithms that can perform tasks previously thought to be quintessentially human, like the driverless car, has generated a lively debate about the possibilities and risks of such developments. We might see output up, prices down, quality and abundance. But as Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum has argued, in addition to being a key economic concern, inequality remains the greatest societal concern with the fourth industrial revolution. Even the Davos Consensus is waking up to the risks of economic inequality. So there is no doubt this new industrial revolution and new age of automated capital will have a huge impact on the labour market. As Professor Andrew McAfee of MIT has argued, we're going to see more and more things that look like science fiction and fewer things that look like jobs. We need to learn from our experience of globalisation. The debate is not about whether or not we want automation. This is a process. It is happening. The question is, will we embrace it or become victims of it? We're a nation of creators, innovators and performers. Breakthroughs in science and technology have enormous potential to transform people's lives and improve quality of life for everyone, and to help us to better share and protect our increasingly endangered natural environment. But it will create winners and losers. Standing idly by isn't the Labour way. We've got to plan now for the challenges ahead. Investing in education and skills to prepare people for the future world of work. Putting in place social protections for people who lose their jobs and helping them to reskill and retrain. Supporting communities affected by the loss of traditional industry to avoid the intergenerational scarring effect we've seen during the decline of traditional manufacturing and heavy industry in mining towns and steel villages. Preventing a race to the bottom with new global agreements on employment rights and protections, standards and pay. Tackling grotesque pay inequality by publishing pay ratios, putting workers' representatives on company boards, and rethinking the modern role of trade unions. Most importantly, making sure that our country is well placed to reap the benefits of this new industrial revolution by increasing substantially our investment in our science base, so that the UK continues to punch above our weight in the world in terms of science and innovation. And we need to continue leading the world on climate change too. It remains one of the greatest threats to the human race. We've got to do more than just our bit of reducing emissions. We've got to lead the world in green technology and industries, building a circular economy and developing new technology to reduce energy and resource consumption. Now, paying for all of this will require some difficult choices, but I think it's time we slayed some shibboleths in this regard in any event. It's already clear that a shrinking tax base and greater concentration of wealth and capital assets makes the debate about how we tax wealth more pressing. This isn't just a question of how we fund our public services, this is a basic question of fairness. There are people generating huge amounts of wealth through good luck rather than hard work. Just look at the explosion of house prices, creating a two-tier economic model where people will inherit hundreds of thousands, if not millions, without lifting a finger. It's one of the key drivers between intergenerational inequality that leaves the next generation worse off than the last. So we should be developing a new model for taxing wealth, not simply income. worrying less about how we tax the dead and more about how we fund the living, and asking those who haven't earned their money to hand over a bit more of it to help those who have. None of this is particularly easy or popular, which is why it's so easy for politicians to park issues in the box marked too difficult. Politics, by its nature, is notoriously short-termist, but if we don't wrestle with these issues now, we will pay a far greater price for it later. That makes the Modern Beverage Report so necessary, and on that note, I'm brought back, right back, to the politics of the referendum and the vote in the House of Commons this week. I know many Remain voters, and I'm sure many of you would have preferred Labour MPs like me to take to the trenches this week and oppose the triggering of Article 50 at every twist and turn. Don't worry, Helene's going to do that in the House of Commons. But I say to you, with some fear and trepidation, but with the slogan I put on every election leaflet, which is, you may not always agree with me, but you'll always know where I stand, at the very forefront of my mind as I say this, I really think it's time to face facts. A majority of voters and a majority of constituencies voted to leave the EU. I wish it wasn't so. I put plenty of shoe leather into campaigning for a different result, and I still believe that we would be stronger, safer, and better off inside the European Union. But imagine for a moment what would have happened if Parliament had blocked the result of a referendum in which 33.5 million people had voted. Britain would have been plunged into a constitutional crisis. People would have taken to the streets. Riots would have been a distinct possibility. Theresa May would have been forced to call a general election, in which Remain or Leave would have been the only question. And the result would not have been the overturning of the referendum result. It would be a very different Parliament committed to the heart of hard Brexit. So let me be absolutely clear. I don't doubt for a moment the integrity or the sincerity of all those people who've been ringing MPs' offices pleading with us to vote a different way. But if people think that overturning a vote at the ballot box by a vote in the parliamentary lobbies would reverse the outcome, I'm afraid they're kidding themselves. This referendum was lost because of a coalition of voters. Sure, there have always been committed Eurosceptics, determined to get us out of the European Union, come what may, and at any cost. But the referendum was won thanks to millions of people who simply felt left behind, who felt unheard, and who wanted to send us a clear message. These are the people at the sharp end of globalisation, the victims of economic inequality and social injustice. And those of us who campaigned in areas where people turned out in their droves to vote leaves, from the streets of Barnsley to Blackbird Leaves, we heard the same phrase repeated again and again in response to our argument that leaving the EU would make them worse off. They simply replied, things can't get worse than this. Sneering at people who voted leave, or dismissing them as ignorant as part of the problem. Across Western democracies, we are already seeing the consequences of what happens when people abandon their faith in mainstream politics. The only way to change course is to change our country. There is no trick and no shortcut to achieve change. In politics, firstly, you have to earn the right to be heard. But for Labour, that means showing we've listened and understood why so many people feel we've left them behind for so long. Secondly, you have to earn people's trust, by showing you've got the answers to address their worries and anxieties, their hopes and their aspirations for them and their families. Third, when you've gained that trust, you have to deliver. It's not about striking a radical pose, it's about making a radical change. Not just honouring pledges and listing achievements at party conferences, but constantly striving to do better and be better. In spite of everything that's happened in our country in the past couple of years, I remain an optimist. I believe just about, the best days of our country can still be ahead of us. There is a whole world of opportunity out there for this small island to punch above its weight in the 21st century. If we're willing to seize that opportunity, if we can make sure that every community has a stake in it, and if we can win the battle of ideas. That's what I said in my maiden speech in the House of Commons. It remains true today, and that is the challenge I believe we must now meet. Thank you very much.